I have nothing to conceal concerning this or any journey I have made, but I confess, he turned back to Balfour, it rankles to be questioned so relentlessly by an interrogator who divulges nothing of his own design. This was rather more aggressively worded than was Moody's habit in speech, but he had spoken calmly and with dignity, and he knew that he was in the right. He did not blink. He stared at Balfour and waited, his mild eyes wide, for the other man's response. Balfour's gaze flickered sideways to the dark-haired man who had made the interruption, and then back to meet Moody's own. He exhaled. He rose from his chair, tossed the stump of his cigar into the fire, and held out his hand. "Your glass needs refilling, Mr. Moody," he said quietly. "Please be so kind as to allow me." He went to the sideboard in silence, followed by the dark-haired man, who, when he had unfurled himself to his full height, almost grazed the low ceiling of the room. He leant close to Balfour and began to mutter something urgently in his ear. Balfour nodded and muttered something back. It must have been an instruction, for the tall man then moved to the billiard table, beckoned the blond-haired man to approach him, and conveyed a whispered message to him. The blond-haired man began nodding, vigorously and at once. Watching them, Moody felt his habitual quickness return. The brandy had roused him. He was warmed and dried, and nothing caused his spirits to lift more surely than the promise of a tale. It often happens that when a soul under duress is required to attend to a separate difficulty, one that does not concern him in the least, then this second problem works upon the first as a kind of salve. Moody felt this now. For the first time since he had disembarked from the lighter, he found that he was able to think upon his recent misadventure clearly. In the context of this new secret, his private memory was somehow freed. He could recall the scene that haunted him, the dead man rising, his bloody throat, his cry, and find it fabulous, sensational, still horrific, but somehow much more explicably so. The story had gained a kind of value. He could turn it into profit by exchange. He watched the whispered message pass from man to man. He could not distinguish any proper nouns. The jumble of unfamiliar accents made that impossible. But it was evident that the matter under discussion was one that concerned every man in the room. He forced his mind to evaluate the situation carefully and rationally. Inattention had led him to err in judgment once already that evening. He would not err again. Some kind of heist was in the offing, he guessed, or maybe they were forming an alliance against another man. Mr. Carver, perhaps. They numbered 12, which put Moody in mind of a jury. But the presence of the Chinese men and the Maori native made that impossible. Had he interrupted a secret council of a kind? But what kind of council could possibly comprise such a diverse range of race, income, and estate? Needless to say that Walter Moody's countenance did not betray the subject of his thoughts. He had calibrated his expression precisely between grave bafflement and apology, as if to communicate that he was very sensible of the trouble he was causing, but he had no idea what that trouble might be, and as to how he should proceed, he was willing to take anyone's direction but his own. Outside, the wind changed direction, sending a damp gust down the chimney so that the embers swelled scarlet, and for a brief moment Moody could smell the salt of the sea. The movement in the hearth seemed to rouse the fat man nearest the fire. He levered himself from his armchair with a grunt of effort and shuffled off to join the others at the sideboard. When he had gone, Moody found himself alone before the fire with the man in the herringbone suit. The latter now leant forward and spoke.
"I should like to introduce myself, if you have no objection," he said, snapping open his silver cigarette case for the first time and selecting a cigarette. He spoke with an accent identifiably French, and a manner that was clipped and courteous. "My name is Aubert Gascoigne. I hope that you will forgive that I know your name already."
"Well, as it happens," Moody said with a little jolt of surprise, "I believe I also know yours."
"Then we are well met," said Aubert Gascoigne.
He had been fishing for his matches. He paused now, with his hand in his breast pocket,
like a rakish colonel posing for a sketch. But I am intrigued. How is it that you know me, Mr. Moody?
I read your address this evening in Friday's edition of the West Coast Times, am I right? If I remember correctly, you penned an opinion on behalf of the magistrate's court.
Gascoigne smiled and pulled out his matches. Now I understand. I am yesterday's news.
He shook out a match, placed the side of his boot against his knee, and struck his light upon the sole.
Forgive me, Moody began, fearing that he had offended, but Gascoigne shook his head.
I am not insulted, he said when his cigarette was lit.
So, you arrive as a stranger in an unfamiliar town, and what is your first move? You find a day-old paper and read the courthouse bulletin. You learn the names of the lawbreakers on the one hand, and the law enforcers on the other. This is quite a strategy.
There was no method in it, Moody said modestly. Gascoigne's name had appeared on the third page of the paper, beneath a short sermon, perhaps the length of a paragraph, on the iniquity of crime. The address was preceded by a list of all the arrests that had been made that month. He could not recall any of those names, and in truth had only remembered Gascoigne's because his former Latin master had been Gascoigne. The familiarity had drawn his eye.
"Perhaps not," Gascoigne returned, "but it has brought you to the very heart of our disquiet, nonetheless, a subject that has been on every man's lips for a fortnight."
Moody frowned.
"Petty criminals?"
"One in particular."
"Shall I guess?" Moody asked lightly when the other did not go on.
Gascoigne shrugged.
"It doesn't matter. I am referring to the whore."
Moody raised his eyebrows. He tried to recall the catalogue of arrests to his mind.
Yes, perhaps one of the listed names had been a woman's.
He wondered what every man in Hokitika had to say about a whore's arrest. It took him a moment to find the words to form an appropriate answer, and to his surprise, Gascoigne laughed.
"I am teasing you," he said. "You must not let me tease you. Her crime was not listed, of course, but if you read with a little imagination, you will see it. Anna Wetherell is the name she gives."
"I'm not sure I know how to read with imagination." Gascoigne laughed again, expelling a sharp breath of smoke.
"But you are a barrister, are you not?"
"By training only," Moody said stiffly. "I have not yet been called to the bar."